Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net. I'm your host, Jacob Lee. This week on Journeys, Jeff Burke. Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy. I'm your host, Jacob Lee. And today joining me via the phone, I've got Jeff Burke. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. And Jeff, what part of the world are you calling in from today?
Well, I'm in the state of Virginia, in a small town called Orange.
And that's that battleground state everybody's looking at this election year.
That's exactly right. I think Obama's going to be down here sometime this week, and I think the other people have already been here and come and gone. So, yeah, it's a pretty exciting time if you're really involved in the politics.
Yeah, we're out in California. Nobody cares about us out here, so they only come out here to raise money. They don't come out
right
here to campaign. You know, million-dollar dinners or whatever, so you guys get all the attention. But that's okay. I won't hold it against you, and I think we'll have a good time on this journey.
Good.
So, Jeff, you are a convert to the Orthodox Church, and what's your baptized name, Jeff?
Adrianos.
Adrianos.
Huh?
And we're going to get into the significance of that, but let's go back to when you were a little child. How did you grow up, Jeff?
Well, I was raised as a Southern Baptist. Both my parents are Southern Baptist, and in fact, my dad has been a member of the same church his entire life, and he's in his mid-70s now. So the family was very active in the local Southern Baptist church, and I was always there. Every Sunday, we were always in church, and they're just very active there. And I can remember as a young child, I'm guessing, you know, something must have died, a dog or a cat or something. And I remember talking to my mother and, you know, concerns about death. And she quoted that passage where Jesus says, "I go to prepare a place for you. My Father's house has many mansions." And, you know, that verse, you know, stuck with me through the years. But that was just one example of that there was a spirituality that was just part of, you know, part of my life, basically. And interestingly enough, though, even though I was raised a Baptist, I really put off being baptized for a long time. And I can remember being, you know, 10, 12, 14 years old, and people were saying, "Well, how come you haven't gotten baptized?" And I just didn't. There was just this pressure, you know, to do that. And you know, when I was 15, I finally walked the aisle and was baptized, I guess, to make everything all nice and neat the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it's, I guess as an Orthodox Christian now, baptism's a little different than it was as a Protestant for you. You know, my daughter was baptized where when I was a Protestant, I never would have dreamed of having a child baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And I know your Baptist roots, probably the same thing that, you know, it becomes a personal choice of a, you know, 9, 10-year-old or maybe teenager. I think I was probably 10 or 11 when I was first baptized. Just for that very reason, it became my choice, not my parents' choice, whether I would be baptized and be a Christian, I guess.
Right, right. That whole idea of believer's baptism. And, you know, I was baptized and kind of things continued on as really nothing changed for me after that baptism. And when I was a senior in high school, and this is, we're talking in the 70s, and during the time of the so-called Jesus movement and parachurch organizations. And I began to go to this group meeting on Thursday night. It was a group called the Sun House, S-O-N, and kind of geared along the idea of the way Campus Crusade for Christ is set up, and very informal, you know, come as you are, which meant, you know, shorts or blue jeans, and somebody was playing a guitar, and yeah, you can kind of picture it. And but one night, somebody said in the middle of a Bible study, they said, if it was against the law to be a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? And that really touched me, you know, because I'd been in the church my whole life, and yet I realized I really wasn't living I wasn't a real heathen by the standards of the people that I was around, but I just felt like I was not living a very deep spiritual life. And so that thought convicted me, that question. And so I went home that night and prayed another prayer, and felt like I'd really done something significant by doing that, and got involved with this group, and got involved with the Bible studies, and there was a lot of street witnessing that went on. And I can remember being out on a Friday night after a football game as a senior in high school, or the following year, and Friday nights at McDonald's, Bible in hand, and accosting people and telling them they needed to repent. And I mean, it all sounds kind of crazy now, but looking back on it, it was a very serious time in my life. And from there, I went on to the University of Virginia and got a degree in religious studies, and immediately got married right after college, and then went off to Dallas Theological Seminary, which is, I suppose, the epicenter of the dispensational theology. And spent a year there and just realized that I really was not going to be a Baptist minister, or I was not going to go into full-time Christian work, and came back to Virginia and taught school for 8 years. And then from there, got back into the family real estate business in 1989. But during that time, I was always very active in the life of whatever Baptist church I happened to be in, and whether it was teaching on Sunday, like Sunday school or Bible studies, or if the pastor needed some help on a Sunday, I would even preach, or I would I was visiting the sick, and music was very important to me. I play guitar, and I was writing music and playing music, and for a time I was involved with the Gideons, who were they're the guys that placed the King James Bibles in all the hotels and motels, and so I was very, very active and have been in the life of the church. And then I had something really amazing happen to me in the summer of 1997. I went on a chapel building trip to Romania, and I'd never really been to Eastern Europe, and we spent 10 days there basically building a Baptist church for this congregation. And I was so overwhelmed with the way these people worshiped. They were, and I'm talking about the Baptists now, their spirituality, their devotion, their seriousness about worship. When they prayed, you could see they were really praying. And I was blown away by what I saw. Our Christianity was like light version, compared to what I saw these people having. And then when I had some time off, I happened to walk into these Orthodox churches. I just wanted to see, what the other side was doing. And so I walk into these churches, and my first thought was, well, they're not using these churches anymore because there are no chairs, there are no pews. They must be using them like museums. They were just big open spaces. And of course, I didn't know that they don't use chairs and pews in the Orthodox Church, especially in that part of the world. But what I did see was, people, they're lighting candles, and they're down on their knees, and they're down on their faces, and they're praying, and here are these boxes with these bodies in them, and people are, coming up, and they're, praying to these bodies laying there. And that part was really freaky to me. I just didn't know what to make of that. But what I came away with, whether it was looking at the Orthodox churches or in the Baptist services that I happened to be attending when I was there, once again, I just couldn't believe the intensity of the worship that I was seeing. Of course, now what I know about these Baptists that I was seeing was that these people had been raised Orthodox, and they were the flavor of their worship was definitely Orthodox oriented. That was what they knew, even though they were in the wrong church practicing it. So I ended up going back to Romania in the summer of 98, 99, 1000, 1001, once again building these churches and being exposed kind of secondhand to Orthodoxy. And then in 02, in the spring, I went back by myself and just made a kind of a pilgrimage up through the north part of Romania and visited some of the painted monasteries up there and got to meet some of the monastics. And that was a very good experience for me.
Now, Jeff, what was the reaction of the Orthodox to you being a Baptist kind of poking into their churches and monasteries and things?
Well, I tell you, that's a really good question. I remember the first year that I was there in 97, and we happened to be out in this little, actually it was a large square outside of our hotel, and trying to evangelize these, there were just literally dozens and dozens of young people, you know, high school, college age kids running around. And we're trying to witness to them. And I remember talking to this young lady. She was probably, I don't know, 18, 19, something like that. And she says, well, just, you know, why are you here? Well, we're here to tell you about Jesus. We're here to, you know, and I went through my evangelism pitch. And she had the most puzzled look on her face. And she said, don't you know that we're already Christians? You know, and that thought hadn't occurred to me. It just hadn't occurred to me. And, she, you know, knowing what I know now, I understand what she was saying. But that was the response, one response that I got. And then there were some people who were very outspoken. You know, they would pass by the sites where we were building these churches, and they would, you know, they would yell things at us in Romanian. Of course, I don't know what they said, but it wasn't good. And but when I walked in the churches, in the Orthodox churches, I really got no response. People were so intent on what they were doing, you know, praying and venerating the icons and things like that, that I was basically invisible, you know, when I was in the churches, the Orthodox churches over there.
So you're basically saying they kind of didn't care who was in the church. They were intent on worshiping God, not what was surrounding them.
That's exactly the case. Yeah, I felt like I was pretty much invisible, and when I would go in there with, you know, maybe a group of my friends and walk through, nobody really ever said anything to us, and they really weren't that interested, really, even though I'm sure we stood out like a sore thumb because we obviously weren't worshiping, and we obviously didn't look like everybody else that was there, you know. But, you know, they really were basically indifferent to us at that stage.
Got it. And so you're a happy Baptist going on mission trips. So why would you consider leaving the Baptist church and making some transitions in your life?
Well, I had a real tumultuous time right there along about 01 and 02. Long story made very short, my wife and I divorced, and we've been married a long time, and it was a very, very bad situation. And in the midst of all of that, like I said, I'd been very, very involved in my church. And when the split came between my wife and I, basically the church didn't step up to really do anything to try to counsel us or to intervene in any way or anything. And I just got real bitter about all of that, and frankly, at the time I was having some trouble with our pastor. He and I had been friends for a long time, and we just knocked heads. And frankly, I think there was pride on both sides, and so I just had a bad taste about congregational style worship, and I just made this vow to myself that I would never ever join another evangelical slash congregational slash Baptist type church. So that if the next church that I belonged to would have to be something hierarchical, where there was some oversight from above, And that's kind of what I set out to do. And I I mean, that may sound crazy, but that's pretty much what I decided, and I was going to stick to it. So I had relocated to an adjoining town, and right down the street was this very old Episcopal church. And it was so close that I could actually walk to it. I didn't even have to drive. And so I thought, well, I'm gonna go in this Episcopal church. And I really had no experience with liturgical worship at all. And I was very impressed with the solemnity of the worship. I was very impressed at the amount of scripture that was used in the services. And there was a lot about it that I liked, and at that point in my life, I was just, I was kind of frayed all the way around. I just basically wanted a place to park myself on a Sunday, and you know, hear a sermon and be some part at a distance, you know, to the whole thing. And that's what I did for a while. And even though the Episcopal Church on the national level was certainly not in tune with my thinking on you know, some of the moral issues. But it was a good place to park myself for a while. And then I ended up getting married again. And my wife and I, we both had this sense that we were looking for something much deeper spiritually than we had known before. And we both had very powerful experiences, you know, as coming from a Baptist background. And we just started, you know, seeking and praying, you know, where God would have us go. And as I mentioned before, I'd been very involved in Christian music along the way in my life, and listening to people like Larry Norman and John Michael Talbot. And by this point, John Michael Talbot had you know, become a Catholic, and he had this monastery out in Arkansas. And I said to my wife, well, why don't we go out there and just visit? And he has these seminars on things like St. Francis and living a simple Christian life. And I said, let's go out there and just spend a week or two and just see what happens. And so this was the summer of 2004. We went out there. And this monastery is very different. It's Catholic sanctioned, but they also have married couples out there who are part of this monastic experience. And we happened to meet this one couple, and they encouraged us to come out and join and, you know, become part of the group. And you know, we weren't, of course, ready for all that. But what was probably most important about visiting with them and meeting them was they explained to me how they had come to know each other and be married. They were both sitting in this class for a class for teacher recertification. And during the icebreaker session, everybody had to say what their favorite book was. And the fellow's name was Don. Don said, well, my favorite book is a book called The Way of the Pilgrim. And this other lady, Mary Ann, says, oh, you know, my favorite book is The Way of the Pilgrim. Well, Don and Mary Ann were this couple that I'm talking about. This was their favorite book. This was their common interest that led them eventually to get married. And so they encouraged us, when we got back to Virginia, to find a copy of The Way of the Pilgrim. Now, I had no idea that it was an Orthodox book at that time. But we buy the book, and of course it's all about the Jesus Prayer and the importance of silence and praying the Jesus Prayer. And so we got the book, and we read it, and Both of us were just very, very interested in pursuing that type of spirituality. And so we basically on our own began, you know, practicing, you know, some of the things advocated in that book, the Jesus Prayer and you know, silence and that sort of thing. And we continued on with the Episcopal Church and you know, we weren't satisfied there, but we thought, well, we're just going to keep looking. Well, the following summer, we were in June of 05, we happened to be out in New Mexico at a Benedictine monastery. It's called Christ in the Desert. And they they practice silence out there, and it's a beautiful place in the middle of nowhere up in northern New Mexico. And we had some discussion with some of the monks, and they encouraged us to become Catholic. So we came back to Virginia in the summer of 05. We looked up the local Catholic priest, and he was more than happy to talk to us. And he says, well, you know, he says, you both are divorced. And he said, you have to be married in the church if you are really ever going to be able to receive the Eucharist. And he said, you'll have to annul your previous marriages. And so we you know, looked into what that meant. And we both came to the conclusion that for us, that was a very, intellectually, it was very dishonest, probably morally dishonest, to say that you'd never been married when you had been married. And we had children, you know. So how could you annul something that you know was there? It's real. It happened. And so the whole divorce thing was one, probably the biggest flag, and then there were many flags that came later as we looked into Catholicism. So we basically coasted along for the next couple of years, still going to the Episcopal Church, still trying to read what we could and practice some type of spirituality at home. And then in the summer of 07, we were back out at Christ in the Desert Monastery in New Mexico, had a chat with the abbot, and he was basically explaining to us what we could do to become Catholic. And he says, well, you know, you can become Catholic, and if you don't want to annul your previous marriages, you can just become Catholics and just never receive the Eucharist, but still be Catholics. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound very good either.
It doesn't really make sense, does it?
No, it didn't make any sense whatsoever, because you're not getting the full life of the church, and from a sacramental standpoint, what I know now, that just sounds crazy to me. If you can't receive the body and blood of Christ and you're in the church, I mean, that's a very sad thought. So our last day, I think it was our last day at the monastery, we're standing there talking to this older monk, and told him some of our, you know, where we were. And he says, well, you know, he says, you could always become Orthodox. And I'll tell you, it was like a light bulb had popped on when he said that. And we both, you know, thought about it, looked at each other, and we said, you know, that is exactly what we need to do. And what's funny about it is we really didn't know what we were even saying. We didn't know what we were even getting into, but we just knew that this was the course that we had to take. So fly back to Virginia. I get on the internet. I find what I think is the closest Orthodox church. It happened to be a Ukrainian Orthodox church about an hour away. And I called up the priest, Father Robert, and he was very nice and accommodating. And he says, well, you know, we have a service on Saturday night. Why don't you come out to the Vesper service? And we did. We came out that first Saturday night we were home and went to the service, and thought it was a wonderful service. We had a lot of questions, obviously, about just what was going on. And then we got up the next morning, Sunday morning, and drove back over to the liturgy service. And of course, there were more questions after that, you know, with the icons and just, you know, what is the priest doing when he's coming in and going out? And, you know, we just didn't know anything about the service.
Was the service in English, or was it in Slavonic?
It was, from what I remember, it was predominantly in English, so we could at least understand the words, you know, that were being used. And so we came out of the service, and I remember asking people questions about this and that, and so we're out in the parking lot, and we were talking to this lady, and she says, oh, she'd be so glad because apparently the Apostles' Fast was almost over. And I said, fast? I said, what's that? I mean, well, I knew what a fast was, but what is this Apostles' Fast? She said, well, it's like 2 weeks where we don't eat meat and we don't eat dairy products and we can't drink wine. And I said, you're kidding. She says, no. She says, we have a fast now, and then we have one. There's another fast around, I don't know whether she said, used the word Christmas. And then at Easter time, there's a, you know, the whole Lenten fast. And I said, wow, this, my thought was, this sounds pretty exciting. This is the kind of thing that really appeals to us. And then she said, and when they don't have services here, I go to the Greek church in Charlottesville. And I said, oh, there's a Greek church. And she said, yeah. Well, I hadn't found the Greek church online. So somehow I got a number for the Greek church. And I frankly was more excited about a Greek church because I had taken Greek when I was an undergraduate, and I'd taken some at seminary, and I just had this sense that I'd be more comfortable. If it's going to be a service in a foreign language, at least, Greek was more appealing to me. That was the thinking then.
Yeah, something you were familiar with.
Exactly. So we got the number for the local Greek Orthodox church, and I called the number and left a message, and I was very impressed when Father Michael Monos called me back that evening from his vacation and told me that he was out of town and that he would be back in a week and we would make an appointment to get together. And so we did. We met with him, and I remember walking into the church, and here's this guy. He was, I think Father Michael was about 40 years old. I think he's 40 now. And here's this guy with his, you know, black beard and his black outfit and his big, you know, silver cross around his neck. And I thought, wow, this is, I know I'm not in a Baptist church anymore. And he sat down with us, and we told him what that we wanted to become Orthodox. And I just appreciate everything about him, how he handled that, because I'm sure he's heard it before. And he explained to us, you know, what a serious step that it was to do this. And it was pretty clear that we didn't know anything about Orthodoxy. And so he says, well, we need to, you know, take this a little slow. We need to make sure that we're all on the same page. He said, I'll be starting a catechumen class in about 2 months. And he says, you know, I would expect you all to be at that. And he said, in the meantime, you need to be in church as much as you can. Every service you can get to, you need to be here. He gave us a book to read that had some very basic things about Orthodoxy in it. And then he gave us a couple of books of prayers, and he said, now I want you to read these morning prayers, and I want you to read these evening prayers before you go to bed. And I'll tell you, that was one of those things for me that was a problem, because I had always believed that your prayer should be extemporaneous. You should pray your own words, and it was kind of a cop-out to, you know, to pray somebody else's prayer. And I've since realized, after starting this journey in Orthodoxy, is that when you're praying prayers of people like Basil the Great or John Chrysostom or, you know, Macarius or some of these other monastic figures or early church fathers, they raise your spirituality because they make you think in their terms, and they just raise the bar on your prayer life. And so that was the beginning of that for us. So we had decided that we were going to be absolutely obedient to whatever the priest wanted us to do. And so we took the prayers home, we took the book home to study, and we just began to come to church, and it just seemed like an eternity until the catechumen class started, because we were just so anxious to, you know, to jump into this just as much as we could. And so that's what we did, and I said to him, well, Father Michael, there's this fast, I understand, coming up before Christmas. Do you want us to do that? No. He says, we don't need to do everything right away. You know, we're going to ease you into this and bring you along at a good pace. And that's exactly what he did.
Now, Jeff, I want to ask you about the prayers, because I think it's important for listeners to maybe get a little more of that and your take on it. As you're praying these prayers, you know, it seems like you're praying other people's prayers, but over time they become your own. Is that what you've discovered?
That is absolutely the truth. Because these prayers, and I haven't researched the history behind each one of them, but these were men who lived at a very high spiritual level. They're the true saints of the church. A lot of them were monastic figures. And these people, they express such fundamental concerns that all of us have. And in some ways, they needed to redirect my thinking, because I'm not used to asking for God's mercy so much, you know, and there's a lot of that. And there's a lot about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And although I had believed in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, when you start praying, you start thinking the way these ancient Orthodox saints believed and thought and prayed. And it truly, over time, begins to transform how you think about praying, how you think about yourself in relation to God, and certainly it changes your attitude toward God. And then especially when you then add in, which we did shortly thereafter, we began to get icons, and you have this icon stand in your house, and you're praying these prayers toward these icons. It's just completely unbelievable what it does to your prayer life. Yeah.
Well, and you also, I mean, there is portions in the prayers for your own personal prayers or your own petitions to be added to those prayers. They're not so rigid that, you know, it's just what these saints said. A lot of the prayers, you know, they have a place for to, you know, name people or cast up your cares. But at least I found in my life, and you can share about your life, that it actually, you know, focuses on what you should be praying for, not what you think you should be praying for.
I agree. I mean, because, you know, the way I was brought up, basically you end up praying for things. You know, God, give me this, God, and it may be good things. Like, you might want somebody to be healed from some sickness or you know, some physical need met for some person who is destitute. But there's way more to prayer than that. And when you're praying for God's mercy and you're asking for, you know, angels to intercede on your behalf, or you're asking for these saints to intercede on your behalf, or you're praying the individual prayers for the different days of the week, it's like you get a different focus each morning when you get up and you start through these prayers. And all through these things, there's this reminder that you're asking for God's forgiveness and you're asking for God's mercy, and you're being made aware yet again that God is holy, and you are not, and that you're just in a situation where you're trying to walk closer and closer to that holiness that's there around you at all times. And
I would add to that you're also focusing in on God and the things that He wants for you, like His mercy. You know, instead of, I need the new car, or I need the new, or so-and-so is sick, it's, Lord, have mercy on them. And whatever His mercy is, that's what we want. Not what we want, but His mercy.
Exactly. Yeah, I would agree with that. A sense that instead of trying to manipulate God, we're just simply petitioning Him for what is going to be best for all of us anyway. Whether we're praying for our parents, or we're praying for our children, or we're praying for our enemies even. It's all about that His will would be done. Yeah.
So you're going to catechism class and doing the Orthodox prayers, going to the services. I've got to take you back, though. What was it like the first time you went into an Orthodox church looking to come into the Orthodox church? Because you said you'd been into it in Romania, but there's a difference when you're there as a tourist versus an inquirer. I mean, what things stood out to you? Because you said you had a lot of questions. What were some of those questions? Because I'm sure other people that are on this journey have those questions.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of the questions, first of all, our attitude was, we were so excited about being there, and we just, it was like, you know, waiting with bated breath as to what's going to happen next, because we just felt like this was going to be home. We just had to get used to whatever home was going to be. And so there was this incredible excitement about being there. But some of the questions were just, some things were very mundane, like, well, when do you sit down? You know, when do you stand up? And, you know, why does the priest keep coming and going in and out of this sanctuary that's apart from the congregation? And, you know, what is this other bread besides the bread that is the body of Christ? You know, I'm talking about the blessed bread. You know, where do these songs come from that, you know, that we're singing? And of course, the first case, it was a Ukrainian church. That was very different music, obviously, than in the Greek church with the Byzantine music. But everything about the service, from my perspective, was very foreign, except that any experience that I'd ever had of the majesty of God and the wonder and the holiness of God that I'd ever experienced in a evangelical or Baptist church, this was absolutely just amped up that first time in the Orthodox Church, that just such a sense of God's holiness came across in what I was seeing in the service. And I really didn't know what was going on, but I just had a sense of it. That's kind of the short answer on it.
Well, what, I mean, how quickly were some of those questions answered? You know, things like the holy bread, were those, I mean, those should be questions that were probably answered pretty up front for you.
Yeah, we just would, like I said, we came out of the first service, and actually the first two services, and as people stood around, they could see that we were new, and they were very happy that we were there, and at least this first church, which was the Ukrainian church, there were a lot of people there who were, I think, that were converts, and they were very happy to answer, and I was confused, too, about for example, the first part of this, I guess it was the Orthro service, these songs that were about these saints. Well, I didn't know that you sang certain songs each day for, you know, whoever saint's day it happened to be. And I was confused by these songs about these saints who I'd never heard of. You know, what's all this about? Most of those questions got answered pretty quickly, just outside the service. It was nothing deep and dark about these sort of surface questions that we had the first time. And frankly, there's so much that hits you the first time you go in. It's like a wave that just rolls over you. You can't even really understand or even be observant of all that's taking place because it's just so different and so much.
Well, and there's so many levels to it and so many different things going on. For those who haven't seen an Orthodox service or been to an Orthodox service, experienced it, I'd almost say it's kind of like a, because you're talking about the priest going in and out of the doors, like a, you know, a Swiss cuckoo clock kind of thing going on.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Because, you know, this guy comes out, says something, somebody over here responds, and you know, there's this drama that's, this pageantry and this drama that's played out. So, you know, especially as a Westerner where there's generally one focus in the services, you know, you were coming from a Baptist and then Episcopal. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure there was a leap between those two.
Yes.
And then there's this third leap of coming into Orthodoxy. But I'm sure there was some familiarity there as well.
Well, there was. I mean, obviously, the whole idea of the Trinity and the idea of a Eucharistic /communion service, I mean, those things were the commonalities. But it was the form in which they were put, you know, that was just really just completely foreign, you know, to me. And but you know what I would do, you know, being the reader, was that I just would seek out books about to understand these things. Like for the liturgy, there's that book by Cabasilis, Commentary on the Liturgy. And I read this book, and I mean, he talks about these levels upon levels upon levels of meaning, you know, of each part of the service. And it's like the more you learn, you realize you'll never get it all. It's just so deep and so wonderful. So you just kind of bask in what you do know and just appreciate what you do know. I feel like each time that I take part in the service, it just gets more wonderful.
Well, and especially as you know, you're talking about the ortho services. The ortho services are so changing. There's so much to be learned in those ortho services.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's a wonderful thing, because when you sit through the ortho service, and there are things about it that obviously they're always the same. And then each, depending on what saint day it is, you get these other special, you know, songs that are put in. But what amazes me every week, I think, is that how when you move from that ortho service to the liturgy service, it's like the intensity level just kicks up. You know, it's like now we're really into the heart, you know, this sacramental moment, you know, this liturgy. And I just love that. I just love that just happens. It's like the orthros prepare, at least for me, it prepares me more for the liturgy. I just can't imagine walking in just for the liturgy service if there's going to be an orthros service before, because it just really sets your frame of mind and your spirit in the right place.
Well, and I wanted to find something for our listeners as well. The orthros service, it would be the morning prayer service. So if you're trying to figure out what's orthros, what are we talking about? There's a morning prayer service that goes on before the Divine Liturgy. Kind of to put it in English, and the Divine Liturgy would be the main service of the Orthodox Church. So for those who aren't schooled in Orthodox verbiage, there's a whole new language to learn.
Oh, yeah.
Just in liturgics. Okay, so you're going to catechumen classes, saying the prayers, and you've become Orthodox. How did that all come down?
Well, at some point in the spring, Father Michael, in fact, right shortly before Pascha, he said, "Well, I believe it's time that you all are brought into the church." And I'm not sure if that's the word that he used. And we had some discussion about whether we should be baptized or not, because we both had been baptized as Baptists. And he said, "Well, were you immersed three times in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit?" And I said, "No, I was immersed, you know, one time." He said, "Well," so he decided that we both would be baptized. So the Saturday before Pascha or Easter, which is Lazarus Saturday, he baptized my wife and I, and then we were chrismated. And so it was pretty wonderful after all that time that our first week as Orthodox believers was that week of, you know, of Pascha. And then the following Sunday, after Pascha, he performed an Orthodox marriage service for us. And so that was just pretty wonderful to say the least. And so now we're Orthodox believers.
Now, so you're in the church. How has your life changed? I think this is the question that people need to hear. What's changed since you've become Orthodox?
Well, I tell you, I would say internally a lot, because I've always been a spiritually minded person. I've always been involved. I've always, you know, tried to do the right thing in terms of being a Christian. I didn't always do the right thing, but tried to. And through living, really beginning to live the Orthodox life kind of on the outside starting last July, really, you know, through the prayers, through the services, and then being brought into the church and through baptism. I think the biggest thing for me has been my self-realization of where I really stand before God. I think in my life prior to Orthodoxy, I think there's a lot of pride that gets allowed in sometimes, and I realized that I was a very prideful person before I became Orthodox, and I know that I still am prideful, but at least it's obvious to me now. And there are things about Orthodoxy that help to break down the pride in your life. You know, the obedience that the church expects. Things that could be considered small things. For example, Father Michael early on says, well, you know, you don't shake the priest's hand. I said, well, what do you do? He says, well, you're supposed to put out your hand and ask for the priest's blessing. And then when he gives the blessing and he puts his hand in your hand, you're supposed to kiss his hand. Well, I'm not used to kissing men's hands, you know. So this was a humbling thing to accept this act of obedience and asking for a blessing and then receiving a blessing, kissing the priest's hand. Things like prostrating yourself in church, veneration of icons, being reminded that you are a sinner, asking for God's mercy and God's forgiveness, asking for other people's forgiveness. It really has hit at that whole area of pride in my life. And I don't see a lot of pride in the people that I've come to know in the Orthodox Church. It's also wonderful that there's no spiritual competition with other people, because it's been made very clear to me that we're all going to stand before God individually and be confronted with our own sins. And I've been told, you know, many, many times by Father Michael and others that, in fact, he quoted John Chrysostom, where Chrysostom said that the church is a hospital. It's a place for healing. It's not a place for people to impress others with their spirituality. And so as that gets modeled for you by people, you know, things like judgment. There's no room for judgment in the Orthodox Church. There's no room for pride in the Orthodox Church. And so there's been a lot of self-realization that there are these areas in my life that just need to be done away with. The discipline of getting up and praying these certain prayers, you know, morning and evening, the whole discipline of going through the church year and fasting when you're called to fast, it's a very humbling thing, and it begins to transform your thinking, and it begins to transform your practice. And I'll tell you, the good thing for me is that my wife and I, we came into this thing together, and you know, we're basically hand in hand going through this thing together, and it makes it so much easier when you've got a partner who is on the same page, on the same wavelength with you going through this thing. So I would say, on the one hand, my self-realization of my own sinful issues in my life has been magnified. And I think on the other side of it, my understanding, as small as it is, on how big God is, has just absolutely been expanded. And part of it is, you know, reading these early church fathers. I mean, I've been a student of the Bible, and you pick up somebody like Basil talking about the book of Genesis and creation, and he asks and answers questions that I had never even thought about before. I mean, these guys, they're just so deep. And when you read these deep men, it has to humble you if you read them, you know, with an open look.
Yeah, I mean, there's, from my kind of conversion into Orthodoxy, there are so many, they're different perspectives from what I grew up as an evangelical Protestant, kind of that Baptist line. Mm-hmm. You know, things about the nature of God being good, and that all things in creation are good. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, everything is good, including Satan at one time was good. He was not evil to begin with. He's fallen. So there's no real evil in an Orthodox perspective. There's just fallen nature, which Christ came to restore. Mm-hmm. And so that it's a different kind of even view of Christ and his mission versus trying to save people out on the street corners, as you might testify to.
Yeah, it's a whole different outlook on all of that. I agree.
And now there's, I guess, you know, prayers is a good place to go back to. You told me a story about how some prayers were answered through your, I guess, newfound way of praying.
Yeah, this is absolutely, I haven't recovered from this one. In fact, I don't think I ever will, but yeah, I was telling you earlier that my wife and I were in Israel this summer, and we had a little free time where I wasn't going to be with the group, so we basically got a car and a taxi, and we drove over to this place outside of Tel Aviv where St. George is buried under this this monastery, or this church there across from the monastery. And you go into the church, and then you go down these steps under the sanctuary, and here is this crypt that bears the relics of St. George. And we were able to get in there and venerate the icons and pray and light some candles. And so we go down to the crypt, to where St. George's body is. And I remember placing my hands on this crypt, and I said this prayer. And basically what it's about is I've got a son who's 18 years old, and he and I had been estranged for the last 3 years. And despite my efforts, he just would have nothing to do with me. He just had some real serious issues. So I put my hands on that crypt, and I prayed to St. George that he would intercede before the Father, that something would be worked out between my son and I. And I remember saying the prayer, and you know, my wife and I, you know, come out, and we leave, and we come back to the States. And it was about 2 months ago that I was visiting with my parents, talking a little bit about Orthodoxy, and we had this DVD that was basically the stories of lives of the saints, and there happened to be three saints on this one DVD, half an hour each, and there was a one half-hour segment about St. George. And so we're sitting there in the midst of, you know, watching this story of St. George's life and hearing priests talk about him. And I got up to check my phone messages because I realized I'd missed the call. And lo and behold, there was a message that my son had called me. Now, my son hadn't talked to me in 3 years. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, I couldn't believe it. And the point was, it happened while I was watching the video about St. George, after having prayed to St. George at his tomb. And so I called, my son's name is Ian, so I called Ian up, and he answers the phone, and he says, "Dad, I want to get together and talk to you." And I just I didn't know what to say, except yes. So that following week, once I got back into the town, we got together, and he came up, and he gave me this big hug, and it was like the prodigal son coming back, and he basically, you know, just wanted to ask me, you know, for my forgiveness for how he had been and all this. And I'm, you know, doing the same thing. And we had this reconciliation that was absolutely seamless and without peripheral issues. I mean, there hasn't been any sense of getting caught up. It was like we both forgave each other where we were, and we just took up from that point. And except for the gap of 3 years, our relationship is wonderful. And I just have to, you know, give St. George a lot of credit for that. Of course, I give God all the glory for that. But I know what happened, and I know how it happened and when it happened. And the fact that I was watching that video tells me that it was through St. George's intercessions on my behalf that reconciliation took place. And it just blows my mind, you know, right now, just thinking about it anew.
Well, and that just shows the power of prayer and the power of those who have left this life but are alive in Christ.
Yes.
You know, we read in the book of Hebrews about the great hall of saints, you know, the faithful who have gone before us. And as Orthodox, we really take that to heart. You know, that there is this great cloud of witnesses, this great hall of saints that are there in the presence of God who have the power to intercede for us because they're alive as, and well, just like you and I are, but just in the next life. So.
Yeah, and people don't understand that when you talk to them about, you know, praying to saints. And that passage you're talking about in Hebrews has always been a passage that I've appreciated, you know, where he says, you know, we're surrounded by this great mass of people. It's like they're cheering us on, you know, as we go through our experience, our journey, our life. And as Father Michael has said to me about the liturgy, it's like all the saints are there with us, and the angels, every time we have a liturgy, you know, whether we can see them or not, they're all there with us. And there's a sense that the church is just one body, past, present, and future. And it's a pretty humbling thought.
Well, Jeff, do you have anything last minute to share before we wrap this thing up?
Well, I would just say to people who are from the same background as I am, that what brought me around was the fact that as I looked at it just from a purely historical standpoint, you've got to say to yourself, where did the church come from? And who are the people that have been constant and steady down through the years? Who are that branch that haven't varied? You know, they haven't changed. And the Orthodox Church is the one that has been consistent all through the ages. And so that's where you have to start when you look at it. You can't look at the fact that it's different or it's strange or it's foreign to you. It's what has been consistent through the ages. And when you walk into an Orthodox church with that approach, I think it takes the blinders off, and you can see things for what they really are.
Well, Jeff, again, thank you for sharing your journey with us. You have a great day.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Would you like to share your journey with us? Please do so by contacting us at journeys@iconnewmedianetwork.com. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net.